This past week, I saw a video of a wolf trapped in a barbed wire fence. It had tried to wrestle free for a little while and then simply seemed to resign itself to the fact that it was stuck there, because the more it wrestled, the more it got torn up by the barbs. And then these two brave men with wire cutters slowly, carefully approached this wolf to set it free, which must have been scary, because even though they were obviously there to save the wolf was snarling and growling at them. It was, you know, a wild animal. So it didn't have any love for these men, even though these men were coming to rescue it. They did carefully get this wolf free, and as soon as it was free, it ran off into the woods without a thank you. It was amazing to see this situation, because we could clearly understand it watching this video, the situation that the wolf was in and how desperately it needed the help of these men. And yet, even though it was helpless to get out, it didn't want them to save it either. We, like that wolf, are trapped in our sin. We are helpless to get out. And oftentimes, even though we understand that we're in a desperate situation that we can't get out of, without God's intervention, we're like that wolf, in that we would rather live in our condemnation and our sin than have God come and save us. But the good news that we're going to see today is that God is faithful to save sinners like us that can't save ourselves. To remind us of where we're at in Romans, as we look at the beginning of chapter 3, Paul is an apostle. That is to say, he was face-to-face, commissioned by Jesus, to bring the good news of Jesus' salvation to the Gentiles. That is to say, the non-Jewish nations of the world. And he's writing this letter to the network of house churches in Rome, a network of churches that he's mostly unfamiliar with, but wanting to establish a ministry relationship with, because he has his eyes set on bringing the good news of Jesus to Spain. Spain was an untouched mission field with no gospel presence, and Paul knew that he was called to move westward. And a strategic location to be sort of his home base to his missionary efforts to Spain would be Rome. And even though he didn't plant the churches in Rome, he didn't know very many people there, he knew that it would be a perfect spot for him to work from. And so he wrote this letter to the Roman churches in order to establish this ministry relationship with them, to show them that he was an apostle called by God to the Gentiles, and also to explain the gospel and the ramifications of the gospel, so that as he approached them to be his ministry partners, he knew that they would be on the same page when it came to what the gospel was, what it did in a person's life, and why it was so necessary. You see, gospel is a word that simply means good news. The Greek word for gospel is euangelion, which literally means good message, the kind of message that when somebody gets, they're excited to hear it. And yet, with the gospel of Christ, this word took on a particular connotation, a particular good news, the good news of salvation. And Paul, briefly, at the beginning of Romans, explains the life-changing power, the radical nature of this good news. And yet, then we see, starting in the second half of chapter 1 through chapter 3, that Paul takes a lot of time to explain why we need this good news, why we need it. Because the thing is, with this good news, if we don't understand why it's so good, we won't appreciate its ramifications. In other words, if we don't understand and appreciate the bad news, which makes this good news so welcome, we will never adequately grasp the gospel. So Paul spends a lot of time
explaining why the good news of the gospel is so necessary. He starts by talking to the Gentiles, saying, you Gentiles, even though you don't have the law, you don't have the Ten Commandments, you don't have this special relationship with God that the Jews have had, you know enough from the created order and your own hearts to know that there is a creator, a God of the universe that's worthy of your worship, and yet you have chosen to worship not just not him, but you've chosen to worship absolutely anything else but him. Everybody worships something, but by nature we worship anything and everything except the God who's worthy of our worship. But then he turns to the Jews and says, you might be looking at these Gentile people that I'm talking to with a smug look on your face, and let me tell you, you're no better off. How much worse is your condemnation, the fact that you have the law, you understand who God is, and yet you also still fall into the same kind of idolatry that everybody else does. You're no better off. And at the end of chapter 2, what we saw last week was Paul explains things like having the covenant, having the law, having circumcision, these kind of covenant signs don't mean anything. What matters is faith. One of the key verses in the passage we looked at the end of chapter 2 last week was when Paul says, a Jew is a Jew inwardly. That is to say, if you're one of God's people, if you've been redeemed and reconciled to God, it doesn't matter if you're biologically a Jew. It doesn't matter if you have the commandments, if you have the law. If your heart hasn't been changed through faith, then you're not really one of God's people. And so what we're going to look at today is the logical ramifications of that. If the Jews are no better off, if Gentiles are no better off, then where does that leave us? If everyone has failed, if everyone is disobedient, if everyone is a sinner, then what hope is there? And that's what brings us to the gospel. As I said, today what we're going to see is that even though we are sinners who couldn't and wouldn't save ourselves, God is faithful to save sinners like us. So in Romans chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, what we see is part of the good news of the gospel is that God is faithful to save despite our disobedience. Look at verses 1 through 4 with me. Paul says, then what advantage has the Jew? Or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were unfaithful? Does that faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. So, as Paul has been talking about how the Jews are just as much in need of salvation as Gentiles, that a Jew is one who is a Jew inwardly, so to speak, he comes to the natural objection that people may have, which is, well, what's the point of being a Jew then? If it doesn't matter, why did God even establish the Jewish people? What's the big deal with being a Jew? He says the Jews have a lot of advantages. He said, in fact, what the Jewish nation exemplifies is God's faithfulness. You received, he says, the oracles of God. That is to say, God's message about who he is, his plan for his people, how to have a relationship with him. He says, you were entrusted with God's message, God's words. What a blessing. He says, you are an example of God's faithfulness to sinful people. He says, your faithlessness doesn't affect God's faithfulness. In fact, in verse 3, he says, does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? No. The people of Israel were wayward. They were disobedient, just like everybody else. But Paul says that that doesn't mean that their relationship with God was pointless. doesn't mean his work was wasted. God's plan of salvation didn't hinge on the faithfulness and the obedience of the Jewish people, which is good news for us. God's plan of salvation was dependent only on his own faithfulness, which is unchanged. It is unhindered by the faithlessness of people. He says, the point, the advantage in being a Jew is not that you get some sort of free pass when it comes to obedience. He says, but what it does show is that God is faithful to unfaithful people. He says that you may be justified, that is to say that God may be shown to be right and prevail when you are judged. Paul shows us here that in no uncertain terms, God's plan for man's salvation is not thwarted by man's sin. And that is good news for us. Even if every single person, as he says, were shown to be a liar, it wouldn't affect God's trustworthiness at all. He can be fully relied on, and the disobedience of the Jews did not derail his plan in the slightest, as if he were caught unaware, as if sending Jesus was some sort of plan B to fix what his Jewish people had messed up. This is why we can count on the promise of salvation in the gospel. As we've talked about the past few weeks, it can be difficult to see through the historical context of this first part of Romans. We can look at some of this and say, well, I'm not a Jew. This is not the kind of thing I struggle with. These kinds of questions that Paul is answering, these kinds of objections that people have raised, are not the kinds of questions that I wrestle with. I don't read the Bible and think, well, because I have the covenant promises and the Ten Commandments, then I must be okay. We might read these things and think, I can understand culturally how Jewish people might have read Paul's letter and had that kind of concern, but I don't. And yet, even though they may look different, we do often struggle with the kinds of things at a heart level that these people that Paul is addressing also struggle with. Like how certain the promise of salvation is. To think, maybe I'm so sinful, maybe I'm so messed up that the gospel is not for me. Or maybe I've been given an opportunity to come to know the Lord, to get right with the Lord so many times. Maybe that's just done. But part of the good news of the gospel is that the promise of salvation is not based on how obedient we are. If it was, we would have lost it as soon as it was made available to us. But it's based on God's faithfulness to sinful people. This is why we can trust Christ on our so-called good days and bad days. You ever have those days where you get into bed at night and you think, you know what? I did pretty good. I felt like a pretty good Christian today. And those other days that we get into bed and we think, how could God ever possibly love a wretch like me? Our good days are never good enough to earn salvation, and our bad days are never bad enough to lose it. The salvation offered through Christ's saving work in the gospel is based on his faithfulness, not ours. That's a part of the good news of the gospel. Paul starts this section with good news. God is faithful to save sinners because his faithfulness is not contingent on our faithfulness. His plan cannot be thwarted. Now he gets into the hard stuff. In the next few verses, we see that God's salvation doesn't excuse us from obedience. Look at verses 5 through 8 of chapter 3. Paul says, "But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us? I speak in a human way. By no means. For then how could God judge the world? But if through my lie, God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come? As some people slanderously charge us with saying, their condemnation is just." If our unrighteousness shows the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Paul's established that having a right relationship with God can never depend on our obedience. It has to be God's grace, his unmerited, undeserved favor making us right with him. So now he turns to what some of his opponents claim that he's saying, because if salvation is by God's grace, our obedience must not matter. If we could never earn salvation through being so obedient, then is there any point in being obedient at all? And not only this, that maybe we should sin that much more, because if our sinfulness shows God's mercy that much more, maybe we should just increase our sin. So in the second part of verse 5 and in verse 6, he says, "Then is God unrighteous to inflict wrath?" That is to say, to punish sin. He says, "Then how could God judge the world?" Paul tells us if God didn't care about obedience, if sin didn't matter, or worse yet, if our sin just only served to show how good God is, then God wouldn't be bringing wrath and judgment on us. There'd be no reason for the gospel. But the answer to Paul's question, is God unrighteous to inflict wrath, is no. God's wrath, God's punishment for sin is right, because if he didn't punish sin, he would not be just. He would not be right. If God doesn't punish sin, if he doesn't care about sin, then he isn't just. Then in verse 7, he turns to that second objection. Well, then aren't you Christians just saying it doesn't matter if you sin or not? If salvation is by grace, if salvation isn't by strict adherence to the law and obedience to what God's commanded, if salvation is by God's grace, so to speak, doesn't that mean that your sin doesn't matter? And that the more you sin, the more God's grace is seen? This kind of twisting of logic is something that people often use, actually. In verse 7, when Paul says, kind of from this imaginary point of view, why am I still being condemned for my sin? Is something that people really think. People who are comfortable with a life of sin will go through all sorts of mental hoops to justify why it's okay that they live the way that they live. I'm showing my age here a little bit, but back in college, I worked at Southwick Mall, a mall that many people here are too young to remember. I worked in a men's clothing store selling suits. I worked for a very nice man, a Muslim tailor, who I got along with very well. He knew I was in college studying to be a pastor, and he would often ask me questions about religion, my view on God, what I thought about world events and these sorts of things. And I often tried, unsuccessfully, to share the gospel with him. And one time he said, "Vinny, I think I'm right with the Lord. I think I figured it out." I said, "Well, I'd love to hear your reasoning." He said, well, as you know, I'm a Muslim. And as you know, I'm not a good Muslim. I drink, I party, I eat bacon. I do everything that a good Muslim is not supposed to do. He said, but I think when I stand before God, I won't face any judgment. He said, because I never go to the mosque, ever. He said, because if I lived the way that I lived and yet went to the mosque every week, then I would be a hypocrite. And I know that God hates hypocrites. So by living the way that I do and not pretending to be religious, I'm not the kind of person that God hates. That's very creative. That's the kind of logic that Paul's talking about in verse 7. If God's truth is shown to be that much more glorious because of my lie, why am I still being condemned? If I don't attend religious services every week, I'm not a hypocrite. So doesn't that show that my sin isn't all that bad? Why would I be condemned for that? So the next logical conclusion is, as we talked about in verse 8, well, why not do evil that good may come? As some slanderously charge us with saying, that is to say that people were really claiming that Paul and the Christian movement was saying this, that sin doesn't matter, obedience doesn't matter. Salvation is by God's grace, therefore just sin more because it just shows God's grace that much more. This is the part that's particularly essential for Christians to grasp. Many people who claim to be Christians live just like the world because they say, God has forgiven all my sin, past, present, and future. So it doesn't matter if I live a holy life or not. Every sin I commit is a testimony to God's mercy. Let me be clear. Obedience does not earn salvation. It never could. But this verse shows us, because of Paul's repulsion that people might think that he believes this, show us that an essential consequence of someone's life being changed by the gospel is that they will want to begin living in obedience to the God who just saved them. They will want to begin fighting their sin. They will want to begin growing in godly behavior. They will want to feed God-honoring desires and starve wicked ones. Our obedience could never earn us salvation, and yet obedience is the natural consequence of a life changed by the gospel. So Paul wants to make sure we understand that salvation is not contingent on our faithfulness. It's contingent on God's faithfulness. That's good news. But it doesn't mean that God's indifferent to sin or doesn't care if his people live in a way that's pleasing to him. God's salvation is contingent on his faithfulness, not ours. God's salvation, even though it is by grace, does not preclude us from obedience. Next, what we see in this passage is that apart from God's work, every single person is a sinner with no interest in God. Look with me at verses 9 to 18. Paul says this, "What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. This is difficult for us to swallow, isn't it? So Paul is wanting to make sure that these people understand exactly the context of God's plan of salvation and the ramifications for them. He says, if you're a Jew, you are just as condemned in your sin as a Gentile. And then he says, not to say that there's no blessing to be found in being a Jew. You had a unique covenant relationship with God. You were given the oracles of God. The plan of redemption was instigated through you. But don't let yourself think for a second that that means that you don't need the salvation offered in the gospel just as much as anybody else. It is to say, in Romans 3 verse 1, there's an advantage in being a Jew. And yet, in Romans 3 verse 11, verse 9, the fact that you have an advantage in being a Jew doesn't mean that you're any better off. We are all equally under God's wrath. And why? Because salvation is based on faith. In verse 11, Paul wants to help us understand just the depth of our situation. Because again, as we've been talking about for the past few weeks, we cannot properly understand how good the good news is without understanding how bad the bad news is. Even though there's value in being a Jew, even though there's value in having God's word, that doesn't mean that they're any better off when it comes to being right with God. It doesn't mean that the Jews were automatically godly because of these things. They were just as much in need of salvation as their pagan Gentile neighbors. Paul quotes here from several different psalms and one verse from Proverbs to paint a picture of just how lost everyone is. No one even cares that they're lost. No one even wants to be reconciled to God. In verse 12, he quotes from a psalm that says, "No one does good, not even one." What does that even mean? Verses like these in Romans chapter 3 show us a doctrine that's known as the doctrine of total depravity. This is an important doctrine that's a crucial aspect to understanding the gospel. It's a doctrine that is based on passages such as this one in Romans chapter 3 that says, every human being, though not as bad as we could hypothetically be, right? We can always say, I could be worse than I am. I'm not out robbing banks. I'm sitting in church. I could be worse than I am. And yet, the doctrine of total depravity tells us that every aspect of who we are is so tainted by sin as to make us totally unfit to stand before God. Though perhaps we are not as bad as we could be, there is no part of who we are that is not tainted and marred and infected by sin. In the next few verses, Paul paints a picture to show us what it means to be in this situation known as total depravity. He says in verse 13, their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Paul here in these next few verses focuses on our mouths. He focuses on what we say. Because for most of us, we wouldn't have to look any further than the things that we say to be convinced that we are sinners in need of salvation. The things that we say are an extension of our hearts. And we could think about even the things that we maybe have said in the past week to someone to acknowledge, I am unfit to stand before a holy God. In verse 18, he culminates this passage by saying, there is no fear of God before their eyes. This is related to what Paul said in verse 11, that no one seeks for God. It's not just that we're unable to be good enough to earn salvation, to be in relationship with God. Apart from God's work in our hearts, we don't even want it. We're like that wolf trapped in the barbed wire who desperately needs those men with the wire cutters to come get him and doesn't want them to. God is faithful to save sinners despite their disobedience. But God's faithfulness to save us by grace does not excuse us from obedience. It's also crucial that we recognize that apart from the gospel, apart from God's work in our hearts, no one is righteous. No, not one. No one seeks after God. There is no fear of God in anyone's eyes. Every aspect of who we are is totally marred by sin. And in the last two verses of this section, verses 19 and 20, we see that we could, I hope we understand by now, we could never earn salvation through obedience. Look at verses 19 and 20 with me. Paul says, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. So whatever the law, it speaks to those under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world held accountable to God. Paul's reasoning here can be difficult to follow, so let's work through it a little bit slowly. What does it mean that the Jews had the law, and therefore, all the world will be held accountable to God? Paul's saying that if the Jews, who had the law, who had the prophets, who had the explicit teaching about God's expectations, who had God living, dwelling in their midst in the tabernacle and later the temple, if they couldn't be obedient to God, then it shows that no one ever could be. If the Jews had the law, and even they blew it big time, then it just shows just how just God's wrath is on the sinners in this world. Everyone is guilty before God. He says, by works of the law, no one will be justified. As we've talked about before over the past few weeks, justification means being made right with God, having our relationship with Him repaired. He says, works of the law, obeying what God has commanded, no one will be saved that way. Through the law, instead, comes knowledge of sin. That is to say, the law was never meant to bring people into right relationship with God. God knew that that would never be the thing. Sometimes we have this misunderstanding about the overarching narrative of the Bible, which is to say that God gave them the law, and because they blew it, God said, oh no, I need to figure out something else. Well, I'll send a Savior who can fully obey the law and die and be righteous on their behalf. God knew that that would never that law would never be the way by which people were be saved. It was never intended to do that. The law was intended to show these people just how desperately they needed God's mercy because they could never do it. We need to understand this, or we will never understand how good the good news of the gospel is. In the coming weeks, we're going to see Paul painting a picture of just how beautiful the message of the good news is. But we need to understand, just as Paul did, that if we don't understand the bad news, then the good news that we're going to be hearing about over the coming weeks and months will just fly right past us. Salvation is by God's grace, by his mercy. It brings us new life. It's not that we need a boost, that we're pretty good people and we need God's help to get us over the finish line. It doesn't mean that we're basically good girls and boys that need some help. We are dead in our sin. We are rightly under God's wrath. We are trapped. We are so trapped in our own wickedness that apart from God's work in our hearts, we don't even want to know him. And the good news is that God is faithful. God is faithful to save sinners like us who could never save ourselves, who don't even understand that we need saving. God's faithfulness to save, thankfully for us, is not based on our goodness. It's not based on our obedience. As Paul says in this passage, let God be true even though everyone else were a liar. Everyone else can blow it, and we do. And yet God is faithful to save. We could never save ourselves. We wouldn't want to be saved if he didn't awaken our hearts. And yet because of his faithfulness to save sinners like us, he does. If you're a Christian, I hope that this passage has encouraged you today. I hope that it's given you a fresh sense of the kind of situation that God saves us out of when we respond to the gospel. If you're not a Christian, I hope that if nothing else, you understand the seriousness of your situation. That you are lost, you are under God's judgment apart from salvation in Christ. And yet God offers salvation in Christ freely to all who would receive it. If you'd like to talk more about what that means, I'd be more than happy to talk with you after the service. Let's pray.